Twitter, Facebook, instant messaging. Once again, an opposition movement is relying on the internet to organize itself and to get its message out. The Iranian government has tried to restrict internet access, but why not just turn it off completely? As NPR's Martin Kosty reports, that is easier said than done.
If you wanted to control the internet, you'd probably try to do it from a place like this. This is the office of Daniel Schwalbe, senior security engineer for the University of Washington in Seattle. It's a dark cubbyhole lit up by the four flat screens attached to his computer. But what really matters is the fiber optic cables coming into the sub-basement under his feet.
For all intents and purposes, this is the main hub where things come into the university.
So let's say tomorrow the University of Washington all of a sudden had a guardian council in charge and they came to you and said, I want you to make sure that these students no longer use Facebook. A couple of keystrokes, we'd be done with it?
They would probably wish it was that easy, but it's next to impossible to do that reliably. We can put in some blocks here. We could go ahead and block Facebook.com. And I would say within less of a day, they would have access to Facebook again because they would figure out a way around that.
For example, students could connect through proxies, friendly computers on the outside that relay the information. Still, the university would enjoy a kind of chokehold on the internet. It could make things harder for students by constantly updating the list of blocked websites and dipping into the flow of information coming through this building. Not that the University of Washington would want to do that, but the government of Iran does.
In Iran, they have a basic filtering architecture that has the average internet connection piped through a government server farm before it goes anywhere else.
Jonathan Zittrain is co-founder of the Berkman Center for the Internet and Society at Harvard Law. He says Iran has used its choke point to do a lot of the same things that the hypothetical autocratic university would do. But like resourceful American students in search of Facebook, many Iranians get around those blocks. Complicating matters for the authorities, Zittrain says, is the fact that social networking services like Twitter are decentralized.
Many people use Twitter, whether they're posting tweets in or just reading what other people are saying, without visiting Twitter.com. They could be using any number of third-party services that have grown up around Twitter. And that way, when the government blocks Twitter.com, the people using these alternatives don't even realize there's been a block.
The government can still gum up the works. People on Twitter can be anonymous, and the opposition has warned of disinformation tweets posted, presumably, by government supporters. The Iranian opposition also has fewer options in its cat-and-mouse game with the censors because of U.S. sanctions, which have kept some American companies from offering services like instant messaging in Iran. Still, persistent internet users find the information they want. The only sure way to block them is to pull the plug on the internet itself. But Danny O'Brien of the Electronic Frontier Foundation says he doubts the Iranian government wants to do that.
It's like closing down an essential utility in order to control your populace. And that's not a decision that you can take lightly.
These days, the internet is so integrated into industry, government, life itself, that even in Iran, shutting it down would be the political equivalent of going nuclear. Martin Kosty, NPR News, Seattle.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. You have nothing to worry about. That's the message from cable company flyers that are flooding mailboxes ahead of the big switch from analog to digital. That switch happens tomorrow. Broadcasters across the country will finally kill their analog TV signals. From member station WHQR, Catherine Welch reports that that assertion, that we have nothing to worry about, may not be entirely true.
The nation's transition from analog to digital has confused so many people that it's inspired a popular online parody.
If you are still receiving your signal over the air, you will have to convert your analog signal.
Analog?
A little old lady with horn-rimmed glasses wrestles with a tangle of wires as she tries to hook up her digital-to-analog converter box.
Will all of this make Jack Benny come back?
Guess what? There are not one, but two digital transitions to worry about. To help you and Granny figure them out, let's imagine a home with two TVs. The set downstairs isn't fancy. It has rabbit ears to tune in standard over-the-air channels. It's for the kids to watch Sesame Street on the local PBS station.
C is for Cookie. That's good enough for me.
For the kids to keep singing along with Cookie Monster, rabbit ears on top of that set need to be replaced with a converter box or maybe even an outdoor antenna as part of the big digital TV switch you've been hearing about.
You may know that digital broadcast television will officially replace analog broadcast, but what does that really mean to you? Well, if you're a cable or a satellite customer, not much.
Let's see about that. The TV upstairs is hooked up to cable so Mom and Dad can watch C-SPAN. But viewers across the country are turning on their sets to discover cable channels they used to watch have vanished. And when they call their cable operators to find out why, they're being told it's part of cable's digital transition.
The cable companies were doing this and messaging this to consumers right as the confusion about the separate broadcast transition was peaking in the marketplace.
That's Joel Kelsey with Consumers Union, publisher of Consumer Reports.
Right now I'm watching the game and the phone is ringing. And why am I not picking up? Because I know who it is. You see, I have Time Warner Cable's caller ID on TV, so when the phone rings, the person's name comes up on the screen.
Ads like this started running on cable to promote the bells and whistles that come with its digital transition. But what's not in the commercial is that cable operators have to make room for caller ID, faster broadband, and more high-def channels. The National Cable and Telecommunications Association's Brian Dietz.
Cable companies are essentially taking analog channels back so that they can launch new digital services.
If subscribers still want those channels, they'll need, you guessed it, a converter box. This is different from the broadcast converter box and could cost an additional $3 to $10 a month. Joel Kelsey of Consumers Union says a lot of viewers are confusing the digital cable converter box with the one Granny was trying to hook up to get over-the-air analog signals.
Analog?
We're getting lots of calls from cable customers who are saying, wait a minute, I thought that my cable company was going to take care of this for me. Why are they asking me to pay more to receive the same channels I've always gotten?
The National Cable and Telecommunications Association says subscribers should have received a notice in their cable bills that they would have to rent or buy a converter box to get missing channels that were part of the basic cable package. In some communities, the duplicate PBS station disappeared. But in many cases, it's the public access channels, known as Public Education and Government, or PEG channels. Now, some subscribers have to shell out extra for cable converter boxes to watch city council meetings or get school closings on snow days.
I was furious because that was not the agreement.
The agreement between the city of Yonkers and its cable company, says Mayor Phil Amicone, gave the city three PEG channels, but they were yanked when Yonkers' franchise agreement expired.
We started getting phone calls from people out in our city. Their TVs had always been able to get these PEG stations. All of a sudden, there was no longer access to it, and they were told they couldn't get it.
Yonkers isn't alone in the tug of war over PEG channels. Raleigh, North Carolina, Sacramento, California, and four towns in Michigan are all battling their cable companies to make sure residents won't need a set-top box to watch government in action. The cable companies have seemed to compromise and are offering subscribers one free converter box for 1 year. After that, it will be up to consumers to decide whether they want to start paying extra for channels that were once standard offerings. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Welch in Wilmington, North Carolina.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. Computers for students are essential, but they are also expensive. Now that budget pressures are increasing, schools are looking for ways to cut technology spending. NPR's Larry Abramson has the tale of two school districts that are traveling different paths toward trimming their tech budgets.
Okay, once you've typed in the ACPSSW, you're going to go to password.
At John Adams Elementary School in Alexandria, Virginia, teacher Amberly Klaus is getting her class of first graders hooked up.
And you're going to type in student.
In this room, each student has a laptop. They're connected wirelessly to the internet. 7-year-old Mireille Gnarek is so young she can't spell the password she needs for World Book Online.
I don't know how to spell students.
Alexandria, a highly diverse system of 10,000 students outside Washington, D.C., has a rich offering of technology, even for the youngest kids. Resource teacher Audrey Bigger says she wants her students to be able to jump online anytime.
It depends heavily on having internet access, yes.
Right now, these kids are working on regular-sized HP laptops that cost the school system about $800 apiece. Elizabeth Hoover, in charge of the district's computer systems, says these machines work fine, but she's looking to go smaller.
This is a HP MiniNote.
Hoover holds up a tiny netbook computer. It looks a little like an overfed smartphone and is part of the latest generation of smaller portable laptops. Hoover says there are two reasons why she's interested.
One is the price.
Just over $400 for this model versus $800 or more for traditional laptops. And
the size of it, it's about 2.6 pounds, which our other laptops, I think, about 5 pounds.
Which makes a big difference when you have a classroom full of little ones carrying these expensive toys around. To accommodate a growing student population, Alexandria is planning to buy 500 HP Minis and take them for a test drive. Beyond the cost, Audrey Bigger says there's another reason to give children technology that's more portable.
We have to play with the toys that they're playing with. More students are using handheld devices for their communication and their creation, and this is more similar to the handheld devices that they're using in their world.
In the Berlin Township Public Schools in southern New Jersey, budget pressures are just as intense. Superintendent Brian Betts says he was considering buying a package of 30 laptops.
With the same amount of money, we got 350 NEOs.
NEOs are small, dedicated word processors. The manufacturer, Renaissance Learning, describes them as the only laptop designed for the classroom. They do not connect to the internet.
There are a lot of parents, including a number of my board members, who don't want children to have internet access in school. So that really wasn't an issue.
NEOs won't play music or send messages, so they don't create the kinds of distractions common with regular laptops. That's something that Renaissance Learning highlights on its website in a laptop smackdown.
You need internet access, kid. How else are you going to IM your friends when teacher isn't looking?
In these online ads, characters representing PCs and Macs appear as charlatans pushing irrelevant technology on students. Teachers at Eisenhower Middle School in West Berlin, New Jersey, like the fact that the NEOs come complete with dedicated software for boosting basic skills. In Dina Botley's 7th grade science class, the teacher uses the machines to test the kids' knowledge of a recent lesson.
Which of those planets is an inner planet? A, Neptune, B, Venus, C, Jupiter.
Students
or
click
D,
on their individual NEO machines, and a wireless signal immediately tells the teacher that they have all responded correctly. She uses the information to gauge how students are progressing over the semester. Students seem comfortable with the machines, but they are not crazy about them. 8th grader Rebecca Miller tells Superintendent Betts, compared to her home computer, this is pretty bland.
Like, when it prints, it looks kind of boring and plain.
Do you have to focus in on writing? Actual writing as opposed to adding graphics? Oh, what a horrible thing.
Alexandria, Virginia, and Berlin Township, New Jersey, are taking different approaches to technology, but they are attacking a common problem, the need to make computers a comfortable part of learning without letting the gadgets take over the budget. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris, and it's now time for All Tech Considered. Last week, we began to look at the exciting, sometimes amusing, sometimes dangerous interaction between our kids and our high-tech devices. We heard stories about smartphones and toilets and unforeseen all-staff emails sent by enterprising toddlers, stories that made us chuckle. This week, we're also talking about kids and technology, but with a more serious focus, as parents try to figure out how to monitor what their kids are up to online. Between mobile phones that cruise the web, homework assignments that need to be downloaded, Facebook accounts, and Twitter feeds, our kids seem to be plugged in all the time. And to find out how to navigate the safety concerns in this new era of connectivity, we turn now to our tech expert, Omar Gayaga, who covers technology culture for the Austin American-Statesman. Hello, Omar.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
Now, as a parent myself, I'm very interested in this topic, and I imagine that lots of other people are concerned about this also. If we want to turn to technology to try to monitor what our kids are up to online, where can we go? What's out there for us?
Well, there's a variety of ways to do it, whether with software or what's already built into the browser and the operating system. But they do require some work and a little bit of research. What you'll want to decide first is how much you want to monitor and what you'd like to filter or have them view. So at the most basic level, you can surf with your kids and set filters in browsers like Internet Explorer, and that lets you block web content specifically by category. If you don't want them to look at violent images or sexual images, there are checkboxes in Internet Explorer that allow you to decide which things are okay and which are not okay. Beyond that, though, there is software that you can install that will alert you, whether through email or text message, when kids try to access blocked internet content. There's also software that will log every keystroke and give you a very detailed report of every activity your kid engages in online. That's sort of the extreme of monitoring, where you're seeing every single thing your kid does online, every keystroke. And to give you an example, the National Crime Prevention Council, the same folks that brought you McGruff the Crime Dog, they have a piece of software for free called McGruff Safeguard that you can install to monitor and block web content. There's a free version and a pay version. It only works, though, on newer Windows PCs.
Omar, I just want to go back to something you said about the software that monitors every single keystroke. If you were to print out some sort of report, what would you see there? Would you see the name of the website that the child accessed?
Yeah, it actually logs the keystrokes. So everything they type in, everything that they're seeing, you can see that. There's one piece of software I looked at that does PDF files. So you can actually see a visual of everything that they saw on the screen as well.
If you're trying to block content and keep your kids away from dangerous things, from violent images or sexual images or anything like that, how do you use filtering software that blocks certain websites but doesn't put up such a strong firewall that kids can't seem to get to anything?
Well, some web browsers allow you to add specific websites that you're okay with. If there's a website that maybe might be caught in the filter, or you see your kids trying to access something and it's not letting them get to it, you can actually add an exemption, as it's called, that lets them get to it. But there's also web browsers built especially for kids. There's one called Buddy Browser, another called Kid Rocket. They do the filtering for you and only allow access to approved websites. And they can also limit the amount of time that kids spend online.
And so if they hit the time limit, 1 hour, time's up, that's it.
Yeah, and there's actually even more complex methods of doing that. There's actually a card scanner where a kid gets a card and can swipe it, and it starts a countdown, almost like a time card, where you are logging in. You can set a predetermined amount of time they can spend online, and then they log out.
You know, if you allow children to spend any amount of time with technology, you see something that's fairly disconcerting. They seem to take to this very easily. And so no matter what kind of software you get, no matter what kind of filtering devices that you try to install, they're pretty good at working their way around this. So how do you make sure that they can't try to go in the side door or the back door or come in through the cellar if you're trying to use some sort of filter?
You know, it really helps a lot to just communicate with your kids. The best way, experts seem to agree, is just to communicate with your kids about what they're seeing, to educate them on never sharing personal information online, and just to have a dialogue with your kids about what they're seeing, especially in cases like cyberbullying that has become a big problem. You want to make sure that your kids have an open line of communication with you to tell you when they're seeing something that's inappropriate or makes them feel bad.
Omar, it's always good to talk to you. Good information here. And I assume that even more information will live online.
Yeah, we'll be posting links to a lot of these products on the All Tech Considered blog at npr.org/alltech. We've also got a lot of other things we're talking about. The new iPhone launched last week, and we're also going to be talking about the new Ghostbusters video game that comes out tomorrow. A lot of topics we've got coming up on the blog.
Thanks, Omar.
Thanks for having me.
That's Omar Gayaga. He joins us most Mondays, and he covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman.
A couple of weeks ago, we were bombarded with emails telling us about WolframAlpha.com. It's a website developed by the British-born scientist Stephen Wolfram. It's billed as a computational knowledge engine, a search engine that is brimming with data. It can answer all sorts of questions. Stephen Wolfram, with a background in mathematics and physics, has huge hopes for this enterprise.
The concept is to take all the kinds of systematic knowledge that have been sort of accumulated in the history of our civilization and try and make them computable and try and set it up so that any question that might be able to be answered from that body of systematic knowledge can be sort of automatically answered by the computer system.
Now, some of the questions that you can enter into Wolfram Alpha, math problems. I was entering quadratic equations that I would make up. It's astonishing. It solves them instantly. It is an astonishing online calculator in that sense. That would be one of the functions that it's performing here.
Mathematics is kind of a part of human knowledge that has been well systematized. And one of the things we're trying to do is to get it so that if science, engineering, have made it possible to compute something. We want to make it easy to compute something for anybody.
You know, I was kicking the tires for the past week entering things, and because it is computational, there is a somewhat Spock-like character to its answers. I entered my name, Siegel, and it tells me that it's the 1,514th most common name in the U.S. and that only 9 times 10 to the minus 4th power of the people named Siegel are Amerindian. It's not especially useful information about the Siegels, but it is a statistical breakdown.
The thing that we're trying to do is to take the systematic knowledge that's been accumulated and be able to answer questions based on that systematic knowledge. For example, if you enter a first name, you might find something that is perhaps more immediately interesting. For example, one of the things it can tell you is it knows the birth rate of people with different first names over the past 100 years or something in the U.S., and then it knows also the death rate of people in general, and so it can work out if you meet somebody whose name is Charles or something, mm-hmm. there's a certain probability distribution for what their likely current age is.
Now, but I saw your online demonstration of putting in 2 names and you get a comparison. Just enter John and enter Paul. You don't get a pontiff in the end. You get a comparison between the names John and Paul.
Right.
I found that with the names Bill and James, Bill James is actually a big deal baseball statistician, but when I put in Henry James, William James, or Harry James, those all popped up with the dates of birth and death of Henry James, William James, and the old band leader Harry James. So is the contribution of the philosophical pragmatist and the Anglophile American novelist, is what they've done ultimately quantifiable? Or do you have wisdom and information that simply will not lend itself to any kind of computing, if you want to know about it?
That's a very interesting question. What about the world, and particularly about the human world, can readily be made computable?
Mm-hmm.
We're kind of starting in our project on things that are sort of more obviously computable, like dates of birth and death. A near-term thing would be a list of the works published by each of these people and, you know, how many copies were sold or some such other thing. Take, you know, Isaac Newton as an example of a person that you're going to sample. Well, then the output of somebody like an Isaac Newton is, in a sense, much more the kind of thing that we already know how to cast into computable form.
Newton, I believe, was also preoccupied with the nature of the Trinity for much of his life. Mm-hmm. That would be a little harder to get at in a quantifiable system.
Well, right. I think his last book was The Chronology of Ancient Kingdoms. He was interested in dating things based on history. That would be a bad source for historical dates, but that would be something which can be sort of ground up into something that is computational today.
But when you talked about the limit, when you acknowledged some limits of computation, you said for now, or at least at the beginning, you have hopes here. You have hopes that actually mathematics and computation can organize and explain a tremendous amount about existence and the universe and life.
Right. One of the things that I've spent a lot of time doing in the last 25 years or so is developing a direction in science that really takes as its foundation the idea that one should be able to sort of set up computer-like programs that represent things in the world. And one of the places that I studied a great deal is the natural world, where we see all these kinds of phenomena that in many cases seem to us very complex and that we seem to be able to describe only in very qualitative terms. And one of the things that honestly surprised me greatly is that looking across all these different pieces of complexity in nature, it's remarkably common that even though sort of what we see is highly complex, what underlies it may be something that is described in computational terms in a rather simple way.
Well, before you go, I just think I should concede here that while I did find that Spock-like quality to some of the quantifiable answers, the answer to the question, Wolfram Alpha, what is the meaning of life, is indeed a quantity 42. And that's, of course, is according to Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So the system is not without humor.
Right, and they restrained me from writing a large essay about what I thought a better answer would be.
Well, Stephen Wolfram, thank you very much for talking with us about WolframAlpha.com.
Thank you.
The book, as we know it, is changing. Electronic books may not be the whole future of publishing, but they'll certainly be a big part of it. And the current giant in digital book selling is Amazon. Its digital book reader is called the Kindle. Now, Google has told publishers that it has its own e-book plan, which could be ready by the end of the year. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
Bookstore owners have been trying to figure out how to get a slice of the e-book pie. The Kindle makes it incredibly easy for consumers to buy a book in seconds, anywhere, anytime, from the Kindle bookstore. And that, says Michael Powell of Powell's Books in Portland, Oregon, is frustrating for traditional booksellers.
We're totally out in the cold. We can sit and press our nose against the window, but we cannot play a role in that. We can admire, regret, but we can't play.
Bookstore owners, says Powell, are not Luddites. Powell's has a sophisticated website, and Powell knows that e-books will play an increasingly important role in the future. He wants to be able to take advantage of the technology.
We need to be able to have access to books electronically. We need to be able to reach our customers with those services. Our customers need to know that they're getting a full spectrum of possibilities when they go to the Powell's website at powells.com.
What Google is proposing, says Powell, might just give bookstores what they need, because Google is developing a different kind of ebook experience. You don't download a book and store it on a device like the Kindle. The books are stored on the web, and you buy access to them. You don't need to buy an expensive device to read the book. As long as you're connected to the internet, you could conceivably access the book from your local bookstore's website, maybe even right from the publisher. Gabriel Stricker, the director of book search communications at Google, calls it a digital book ecosystem.
A digital book ecosystem is basically an online space where you have the ability to have your books be discovered and make money off of them.
Stricker emphasizes that this idea is still in development, but eventually he says Google's ebook service should be what he calls device agnostic.
We want to be able to have folks search for books anywhere, and not just when they happen to be at a computer. That could be when they're on a PC or a smartphone or a netbook or a dedicated reading device.
Publishers are likely to welcome this device-agnostic concept because they've been concerned that with the Kindle, Amazon could control not just the ebook market, but the price of ebooks. And Google has the size, money, and technical know-how to compete with Amazon.
The difference is that you're not possessing a file, you're seeing a file.
Mike Schatzkin, president and CEO of the Ideological Company, is a consultant to publishers. He says Google may also solve a problem for publishers that has haunted both the recording and film industries.
What Google accomplishes here is that they totally sidestep the piracy and digital rights management issue, because there is no possession of the file. Therefore, there is no way for you to give the file to anyone else. And they just don't have to worry about that anymore.
The question is, are avid readers who are just starting to accept the idea of electronic reading devices ready for an even more intangible notion of the book? Google's betting they are. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.